we came up with the sign, simply said in four words, I am a man. It was the shortest phrase that we could get that would instill in them a sense of pride, not just for what they had done, but what they were doing to try and change the system. The city went bananas when the sign showed up.
He co-authored one of the most famous slogans in the history of the civil rights movement and went on to become a leading figure in one of America's largest and most influential unions. William Lucy shares his story next on A Third of Your Life.
You spend a third of your life at work. We're all about making it better. This is the Rutgers School of Management and Labor Relations podcast.
When black sanitation workers walked off the job in Memphis, Tennessee in 1968, they demanded more than higher wages and safer working conditions. They wanted to be treated as human beings. So they carried signs bearing the simple but powerful phrase, I am a man. William Lucy, a young official with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, helped to create that now famous slogan. And he went on to become a key figure in the civil rights movement and the highest-ranking black person in the labor movement. Today, at the age of 89, he is still dialed into both. Lucy shared his remarkable story with Francis Ryan, a labor historian in the Rutgers School of Management and Labor Relations, and we're excited to present their complete, unedited conversation. Originally recorded in 2021, here are Francis Ryan and William Lucy on this special edition of A Third of Your Life.
I'm very pleased to have an opportunity to talk with you. To give you a sense of where I am right now, I'm actually in the Labor Education Center at Rutgers University here in New Brunswick. And I'm here in my office and can't see outside, but it recently has snowed. So we still have a lot of snow on the ground. And I want to ask you to let us know where you are right now.
I'm at home, Washington, D.C. Sunny day. 44, 45 degrees temperature, perfect day.
Great. I want to welcome you, especially on behalf of our students, especially. We have a wonderful group of students here in the School of Management and Labor Relations. And so many of them are working students. You know, they're working at least part-time. Many of them are working full-time to put themselves through their education. And I know that a lot of them would be very interested in hearing about your life and a little bit about maybe where you were born, what your early life was like. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I was born in Memphis, Tennessee, 1933, November. Spent my early growing up years there in Memphis, left Memphis about 1942, about March or April, somewhere in there, but I went through a portion of elementary school right there in town. My family left Memphis on the outset of World War II. My father left first as a part of a recruitment effort for defense workers. My mother and my brother, we left a few months after that. We wound up in Richmond, California. We lived an area by and large designed for defense employee housing. Grew up there, went to finish elementary school and then went to junior high and high school in Richmond. Completed my high school education at El Cerrito Junior Senior High School. Spent a little bit of time at Contra Costa Junior College, which is located in the county that we lived in. Spent a little bit of time at the University of California Materials and Research Department. I went to work first for the Defense Department at Maryland Naval Shipyard there in Vallejo, California. Spent about 2.5 years there and then went to work for county government, government of Contra Costa County, which is the major county, or one of the major counties in Northern California. As a part of that work, as I say, I went to the materials and research area of the University of California in Richmond, California. And from there, we went into the involvement with organized labor initially.
Could I ask you, what, were your parents involved with organized labor before you?
No, no, not at all. My father was a mechanic, but he was a welder in his work for the Kaiser shipyards. So he may have had some exposure to it, but I'm not aware of it. My mother was a seamstress, and to my knowledge, she had no engagement or involvement with labor. Mm-hmm.
So tell me about when you first joined AFSCME, which in case any of our listeners don't know, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees is the largest union in the AFL-CIO that represents government sector employees at the state, municipal
level. We represent by and large state and local government employees, a smattering of federal sector. But my involvement with AFSCME, it's a, sort of a longer story. When I went to work for Contra Costa County, this was in 1953. I was recruited by the county to come to work. This was the period when the major highway construction program was underway. President Eisenhower initiated what was called the Federal Aid to Secondary Highway Construction Program. And states across the nation became engaged in building out their highway systems to meet their local needs as well as meet the federal standards that were being set. So I went to work in the Public Works Department at Contra Costa, in 1953. I worked there for 13 years. And in the course of that, became involved with the what was the County Employee Association. It was not a union, but an association of county employees. And during the course of that experience, there became a discussion of whether or not the association was meeting needs of the particularly blue collar employees. And 52, 53, a discussion broke out as to what we wanted to do, because Contra Costa County was a heavily unionized county. And our view was that the civil service system that covered public employees really had gone somewhat beyond their initial responsibility, and that being to certify employees who had passed the civil service test and was eligible for employment. And our view was that that system didn't really meet the needs of workers, because it didn't deal with our ability to participate in wage setting programs. It didn't speak to our needs in terms of benefits related to our employment. And we simply thought that the civil service system, as good as it was an extension of the employer. And we simply thought we had a right to sit down when we discussed wages and other conditions. And out of that grew a broad discussion of whether or not we really wanted to be regular trade union, a regular trade union workforce and activity, or whether we want to remain as a civil service system. We opted for both. And as a part of that, we joined into a nationwide discussion about the role of public employees as employees, not public servants. And we thought we had an entitlement to discuss a number of things that were not a part of the civil service process.
So what year did that happen, that you joined the union, joined AFSCME?
Well, we joined AFSCME about 1958 or 57, 58, somewhere there, because we went through a process of deciding to be a union. And then once we made that decision, the question was, okay, what union do we want to be a part of? And AFSCME at that time, was headed up by, in 1964, was elected a person by the name of Jerry Wirth as its national president. And he really believed very strongly in the rights of public employees to have access to the traditional programs of collective bargaining and right to organize. And we believe very strongly in that. And so we joined with AFSCME. That would have been 1953 or four.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that when Jerry Wirth came in as the president of AFSCME.
I'm sorry, 1963 or four, I'm sorry.
Right. So he comes in 64. And you know, he comes out of New York City. He's a great organizer, built up District Council 37 there from just about under 1,000 to 10,000 by 1961. And, you know, what was happening in New York was happening all over the country with AFSCME. I mean, AFSCME was growing by leaps and bounds at that time. And as a young person who was involved with the trade union movement at that time, were you aware that there was something special happening?
Oh, absolutely. As a county employee who was really experiencing a whole new perception of yourself as an employee and the rights that went along with that, we were well aware that there was a mood shift taking place about among county employee workers and public sector workers in general as to how they saw themselves. We used to make the discussion that there's very little difference between a truck driver who drives from First Street to 125th and then a private sector truck driver who takes over and drives from 125th on. I mean, same skill set required, same knowledge and experience. So we started to see ourselves as regular employees entitled to all the rights that private sector workers had under the National Labor Relations Act and their ability to collectively bargain.
Now, the thing about AFSCME's organizing at that time, they were organizing in sectors that included a lot of Black workers, Black men and women who are working in healthcare and municipal services. And there seemed to be a connection between the Black freedom struggle at that time and the labor movement. There was this merging together. And tell me about that. Was that something people were really aware of and trying to develop and build kind of community connections along those lines too?
Well, I think President Wirth brought to the organizing effort a sort of a new approach to it. And that is the focus on community issues and around community workers, because so many of public sector workers were on the workers of color side. And so he had the civil rights tactics coming out of his background of organizing. Now, merger of those two things produced a whole new approach to organizing in the public sector. Mm-hmm. And it caught fire because people had, while they worked in the public sector, accepted the terms of employment and what have you, but they really believed that there was something better in store and they believed themselves to be well-qualified employees and entitled to sit at the bargain table. So you saw the New York experience where DC 37 hospitals, administrative employees, a sector of the workforce that was heavily dominated by Black and brown employees who were, as a matter of fact, was in the low end of the wage and benefit scale compared to private sector workers at that time.
Did you see that happening in other places outside of New York as well?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It was happening in all the major urban areas, you know, Philadelphia, Detroit, Cleveland. And if you tracked our organizing schedule, so often workers were reaching out for the union to say, we like what you got to say. How does that fit our situation? And the union was organizing by leaps and bounds, as you say, and principally because public sector employees were beginning to develop a different view of themselves as workers. I mean, the public sector was holding to this sovereign doctrine that, you know, we were above responsibilities for bargaining with workers. Well, you know, cities and counties and states, they may have a lot of responsibilities, but one of them is managing a rather large workforce and making sure that those workers have access to decency and dignity in the context of the day-to-day issues that affect their wages and their benefits.
Now, we know that AFSCME had large chapters in places like New York City and Philadelphia and Detroit. But we see in the 60s too, there is really a resurgence of organizing in the South. And, you know, there's always been a strong resistance to union organizing in those areas. And we see by 1968 in Memphis, a major moment in the history of AFSCME, in the history of American working people, with the Memphis sanitation strike. And I know that you played a very significant role in that moment. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about what brought you back to Memphis to work in helping those men who were on strike.
Well, in all candidness, let me say, I like a lot of staff, was wind up in the wrong place at the wrong time. And one particular day, I had been assigned to Detroit and got a phone call from the office that says there's something happening in Memphis. Can and will you take a look? And Memphis was sort of symbolic of a large section of the country that got no attention at all. And some basic functions, and particularly sanitation work, those functions were almost exclusively reserved for Black and brown workers. And particularly across the South, where you're dealing with private sector garbage collections. I mean, in the downtown section, that's private sector, so it's got a better wages, a better business, but the public garbage collection responsibility for private homes and what have you is almost exclusively reserved for sanitation work of a city. And Memphis was an area where the workers themselves knew that they really needed something to give them an opportunity to have a better life. The confrontation in Memphis was not inspired by the national union. It was a phenomenon that grew out of the frustrations of the workforce in Memphis. Here you had men who had worked the better part of their adult life for the city, some working 15 to 20 years. Their wage levels were $1.25, $1.35 an hour. They were confronted with equipment that came from the Stone Age. I mean, that they simply could not get the actions that they hoped for just to make the job a little bit better, where they could do it better, a little safer, had some of the benefits that grew with the type of work that grew with the type of work they were doing. And they themselves decided that they wanted a union. And they appealed to the city to allow them to have a voice in some of these issues that concern them. And Memphis had just gone through an election for a new mayor's form of government, a new structure type of government, from a commission-ran government to a strong mayor system. And unfortunately, both the election and the union's effort ran head on together at a time when it was just not the best time. No union in its right mind would have a sanitation strike in February in the South, because workers don't strike because they're angry, they strike because they're frustrated. And this was a classic example. Men had gone for years, some working below the minimum wage, others having no voice in safety procedures, no grievance procedures, that we see as a part of every basic contract that exists. No vacation time, no sick leave, none of the things that a worker today would anticipate either existed by virtue of the union or simply by the personnel systems of the employer. So the strike grew out of that. Probably the catalyst was two men who had worked for the city for some time. In the midst of all of this, were scooped up into the back of their sanitation truck, caused, as best we can tell, by some sort of a faulty electrical system that was triggered by a lightning strike. And two men lost their lives. And then we discovered that there were no procedures to deal with a situation like this. Therein was the basis and the catalyst for the strike.
Now, as part of that strike, one of the iconic images that a lot of students of history see are the striking men with the placards that say, "I am a man." Mm-hmm. I know that was something that you came up with. And I was wondering what the origins of that were. And also, when was the exact moment when you realized that should be something that became a slogan of this struggle?
Well, two things go on. I mean, first of all, the city of Memphis and its leadership, particularly the mayor, had no intentions of dealing with a workforce made up of Black men and, by and large, the lowest level on the scale, the sanitation workers. Their claim and their problem were legitimate claims and problems that any leadership would sit down and talk about. But this city took the position that they had no right to demand that the city address any of these things in the kind of forum that they wanted. And so they struck. And our role was to try and do all we could to help them win this effort. And we were aware that there was no law in Memphis, or probably a lot of other places across the South. But if we wait until somebody wants to pass a law to give us the right to have access to some kind of a bargaining process, we'll never have change. So the strike took place. And during the course of it, it became clear that there had to be something that was going to hold this together. And we came up with a slogan because, across the South, you can go from boy to uncle to grandfather without ever passing the station of being a man. And a tremendous religious leader, a fellow by the name of James Lawson, during the course of our meetings, either he or others would mention the point that the refusal of the city to sit down with his workforce is treating them as if they're not men. And one of the great sources of pride among these men were they do some of the most difficult work under some of the most dreadful circumstances, and they're simply not treated as men. So a pastor by the name of Malcolm Blackburn, he and I were charged with finding some glue to hold this together so that they wouldn't have to go back to work with no sense of broad community support. So we came up with a sign, simply said in four words, "I am a man." It was the shortest phrase that we could get that would instill in them a sense of pride, not just for what they had done, but what they were doing to try and change the system. And needless to say, the city went bananas when the sign showed up. It was a sense of pride to the workforce, and it brought the community into the discussion, because every Black man across the city of Memphis understood the absence of being treated as if they were a man.
Mm-hmm. This strike was happening in those early months of 1968, and there was a larger movement happening here, of course.
Right.
The Poor People's Campaign that Martin Luther King was really beginning to push at that time. And, he came to Memphis to support this strike. And did you have interactions with Dr. King during those days?
We met during that period a couple of times to talk about the role and function of the union and the support that was coming from the community and what he would bring to the issue. Let me go back to your earlier part. Dr. King, who had really come through the movements across the South, but really came to the point where much of what was happening had to be related to the economic situation of the people who were struggling. And he saw in Memphis the classic contradiction between people who worked every day, yet not only could not raise themselves out of poverty, but had no mechanism to do that. The National Labor Relations Act, and one of its contradictions was it provides a mechanism for folks who are skilled, very professional, and it gives them a right to bargain. That's at the higher end of the wage and benefit scale. At the lower end, the National Labor Relations Act specifically excludes, as you well know, public sector employees and does very little to enhance the ability of low wage workers to find a mechanism. So Dr. King saw those as contradictions and really thought that the workers had a right to not only bargain collectively, but to mobilize around doing that. The Poor People's Campaign gave an opportunity to demonstrate that. Here are workers who are not arguing about what they do, they simply want to have a voice in how they do it.
So the 1968 strike ends with the contract recognition of the union. Of course, Dr. King is assassinated during that you know, terrible moment in April of 1968. What happened in the days after that? Was this seen as a turning point for AFSCME? Was it a turning point in, let's say, that connection between the community, the African American community, and the trade union movement in Memphis? Was that seen as a permanent development in your thoughts?
I really can't say. I mean, in those days, while the national labor movement came to the aid of the strike and the strikers, the Memphis labor movement was a different story because these workers were not workers who had even recognition by the movement itself locally. And during the course of the strike, the sort of the civil rights association, the political movement of the strike caused some locals in the Memphis area to be very reluctant to reach out and be supportive of the strike. I would say the rubber workers, retail clerks, which is now a part of the United Food and Commission, were very helpful. But others were slow to come. They came, but they were slow. How we were able to build the support was based on the community's clear identification with it. For long, every church, every social service organization, every club on the Black side of town were sympathetic to the strike and had tremendous support. Dr. King's assassination triggered another set of concerns, and that is, you know, how do we keep this going? Well, once Dr. King's funeral services and other activities were passed, Lyndon Johnson brought somebody from the Labor Department to try and play a role in getting the two sides to think about what it is we're trying to do. And there was a fellow by the name of James Reynolds, who was the Undersecretary of Labor at the time. Just tremendous commitment to resolving these kinds of problems. He not only worked with the two parties, I mean, the city and the union, but he played a role in identifying people across the community who had some experience in these kinds of confrontations. And he managed to put us all together and started us to work.
Right. Now, one of the things about this moment in the late 60s, you know, AFSCME is beginning to bring in 1,000 members a week sometimes. You know, and it's the largest, you know, it's got about 500,000 members. By 1977, you have 1 million members. So there's an incredible growth. And, you know, I know that a lot of the new members in AFSCME chapters were working class women. And I was wondering if, you know, we're talking about the I Am a Man placard from 1968, all the men on strike were, I mean, they were men, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there are women, there are working class women who are coming in to ask me at that time too. Tell me about that. Were there particular leaders that you remember or a particular set of ideas that some of these women brought with them?
Well, I mean, that slogan was specific to that situation. I mean, at a point in time, maybe still true, I'm not aware right now, a little over half of our membership were women, and they were organizing themselves like other parts of the union was doing. We've had on our board, let's say our executive board, almost a majority for any number of years were actively engaged women, and they were organized in areas that were simply ripe for organizing: the healthcare sector, the administrative sector, professional class. And these were people who had decided that as a public sector employee, they were entitled to some things that the civil service and merit system did not give them. And they wanted a mechanism so that they could participate fully. And it was not all about money. Much of it was about safety. Much of it was about leisure time issues. I mean, things that would be a normal part of any set of private sector negotiations. Right now, I've been probably 52-53% of our membership are women, and the leadership level is such that it attracts and brings in other women concerned about the unique problems that the female workforce has.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is an issue, you know, speaking here at Rutgers, our institution, the School of Management and Labor Relations, has always been at the forefront of research on working class women, labor feminism, and so many of our students are young women who work in retail and food service. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's an important question, I think, to put out there that, you know, the role that women are playing in shaping AFSCME and the trade union movement in general. Was there any pushback to that?
Well, I suspect there was, but depending on where you were at. But if you look at the growth patterns, and you could early on see that the growth was among those functions that were by and large female related. And our female leadership then and now was really very aggressive in going out to recruit you know, members who had no union, or recruit more to make the union better. And I think we see that in across the trade union movement now. Yeah. And some of the real difficult campaigns, they've been won by women organizers and women administrators.
So in 1972, you come in as an international leader with AFSCME. You come to Washington and you know, you become the International Secretary Treasurer. Is that correct in 1972?
I know the timing may be a little old. I came to work for AFSCME in 1966. Uh-huh. I came from California to here to start up what we called our Legislative and Community Affairs Department. We noticed early on that the growth of the role that the federal sector was playing in the policy direction and implementation at county level was growing simply because of the financing and grant process that was being developed between federal government, state and county and city. And we didn't really have, nor did we know the role that we should be playing in those kinds of situations. So the union set up this department, Legislation and Community Affairs. And the president asked if I would come back and be a part of that, and I did. So I had worked for the city, for the union for 6 years or so prior to 1972. I was asked if I would consider running for national office because the brother who held the office at the time was looking to do some other things. Mm-hmm. So I agreed that I would stand as a candidate for election in 1972. For the office of Secretary of Treasury. And so I held that position until I retired in 2010.
So as a leader in Washington at that time, when you came on as Secretary of Treasury, how was that different? Was that something that, I don't believe that AFSCME had any African-American top officers at that level before that, is that correct?
We had vice presidents, but we didn't have either of the national offices, a president or secretary of treasury. Mm-hmm. We had a number of vice presidents who served on the executive board. Mm-hmm. My election in 72 was unique and was different.
And how old were you at the time?
33, somewhere in there.
So in the labor movement, that is very, very young.
Well, you said that, I didn't. I think it had a lot to do with where the union saw itself trying to go. We had taken on new and different organizing tactics, new and different organizing targets, an additional role of political action within the union to try and not only secure by legislative means the benefits we didn't have. We were looking at legislations that in and of itself created discriminatory systems at work level. So it was not my decision to be an elected office, but I was asked. And by 1972, I think I was familiar enough with the size, scope, and focus of the union that they thought I would make a good candidate, and I wasn't going to question their judgment, you know. But I was elected in 1972 and served for almost 38 years.
Okay. So, you know, it's an important moment, I think, not just in AFSCME, but in the entire US labor movement. And I'd like to ask you this question about leadership, because I do think leadership matters. You know, who's in leadership positions make a difference in any organization. And I want to ask you, you know, would you like to see more women and people of color in leadership positions in trade unions? And how does this help the labor movement if that is accomplished?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's no question that their ranks ought to be increased. And I think they are being increased. We've got unions who have national offices of color now that you would not have guessed 5 years ago, 10 years ago, primarily on the male side, let me say, but within the ranks of leadership, you're seeing more and more females, which I think is the right thing to do. And secondly, the workforce now is different than the workforce of 30 years ago. We really should not be spending our time trying to convince people that they ought to be a part of the labor movement. We ought to spend time making those who want to be a part of it. And among that group, you will find women, young people, Black, brown, who really have the ability to reach out to the constituencies that want to join trade unions now, want to help form organizations that represent the interests of workers.
Mm-hmm. Let
me just say this too. Yeah. I mean, you've got on the building trade side, for instance, there's always this story, well, the building trades will never change. Well, that's fundamentally not true. You've got Ken Rigmaiden. You've got any number of new leaders in presidential and second officer roles.
One of the things that AFSCME was at the forefront in coming into the 70s and 80s, you know, in 1983, AFSCME puts out one of the first international unions to put out a resolution favoring and demanding equality for sexual minorities in the workplace and in society. Mm-hmm. And this has become, I know, with AFSCME and across the labor movement, a very important part of you know, the consciousness and the policies. And I was wondering, what made AFSCME at the cutting edge of that moment? And what role did you play in that resolution?
Well, I think, you know, AFSCME as an institution has always been sensitive to the impediments that kept people from getting what was justly their rights. And I've tried to be sensitive to that, not because I was a Black officer, because it's just fundamentally right. And I suspect, you know, others saw this in our activity and saw it in our policies. We have always tried to move our national policies down to the local level. And once you get there, you're going to attract an awful lot more people if they're listening to your message. You made a point a while ago about our growth rate. At one point in time, we were netting new growth, 52,000-53,000 a year.
Yeah.
And sometimes we used to say, and I said cautiously, we were organizing in spite of ourselves. So the point is, if your message hits the core concerns for potential members, they're going to join.
Yeah. One of the things I love about Rutgers is that it's a truly international institution.
Mm-hmm.
By that, I mean, I have students, I sometimes teach large sections of students, 70 students in some of the working class history classes I do. And last semester, I had a class that had students, because I asked them where they're from and where their families are from sometimes. And I had students representing every single continent, except for Antarctica. You know, like we had students from around the world. We have students who were born in Africa, or their parents were from there. We have students from Argentina. And students from Mexico and across Europe and so many students from China as well, and Korea, across the world. And one of the things I've always appreciated about your leadership is that you're international in your vision. You understand that the working class extends beyond boundaries, which of course is an important message in today's moment that we're living through, our historical moment. And I want to ask you about this. One of the things that I know that you were involved in was placing the labor movement, the entire US labor movement, and placing AFSCME at the fore of this, in the movement to end apartheid in South Africa. And it's probably the first thing that I knew about you. I grew up in an AFSCME family and I used to get the magazine at home. And I was aware that you'd been arrested, that you had been involved in pushing this policy. And I thank you for that. And I want to say this now, that it was part of the change in my own consciousness about wanting to study working class history and having a sense of pride coming from such a family that came out of AFSCME. So and I appreciate what you did with that, because it taught me and taught many people in my generation coming into the late 80s, early 90s. Tell me about that effort and the policies that you helped to promote.
Well, let me, that's a long story, but it's one that is that's close to my heart. We have always been, because by and large, because of President Jerry Wirth, we've always looked at our work as international work. We believe that the public sector is really, in many countries, an extension of democracy, an extension of the democratic process. That even though it may be a poor country, you know, people and workers are entitled to some very basic rights. I mean, right to food, right to clean water, right to clean air. And it's the public sector that's by and large responsible for some of this, or should be responsible for it. We should not leave quality of life issues in the hands of the private sector, particularly when there's a profit margin involved. That's our basic belief. So we've been a part of what we call Public Service International for many, many years, because we thought the public sector would be much more capable of advocating for democracy and democratic process. So we've been a part of that movement. And South Africa was the ultimate contradiction to that and a lot of other things. And it was my belief, and I was joining other people, certainly wasn't mine alone, that the US labor movement ought not be a part of supporting a structure and function of government that depressed over half of its people, that gave them no rights to citizenship. And apartheid was not a historical form of government. It was a government and process developed during the 40s, 50s, 60s. And that it was a contradiction of what we believe was right. So we set out to at least raise the level of understanding of what it meant. And I was quite forceful in my views. And I think others had different views and maybe had the same hopes, but it had to be done. And we saw our government as close to apartheid as you could get. And it was sort of go along, get along. No raising of the real challenges for why we call ourselves a democratic society, yet we are aligned with an apartheid government. So we just joined forces with people and thought about ways and means of weakening the apartheid system. And ultimately successful. We had the, I think the high point of our lives was the release of Nelson Mandela and working with him and some of his folks during the course of the struggle.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about that when you're engaged in political struggle, sometimes it takes more than a lifetime to see the end result. You know, I think about, so many movements, you know, the anti-slavery movement, the struggle to end slavery in this country. But this was a moment where you actually got to see the end. Yeah. And tell me about, that must have been something, I mean, because Nelson Mandela did come and meet with AFSCME. And ask me officials and meet with you. Tell me what that was like.
Well, let me go back a ways. Before, just after his release, we met in Durban to talk about not only where he and the ANC saw themselves going in some of the other movements in country and how we could be helpful in that part. As you probably well know, the ANC, everybody had a question of who were they and whether or not their politics matched ours. Well, you know, I mean, the trade union movement, COSATU and its affiliates, were unions working to uplift the South African community. And we tried to do what we could do to translate some of our skills and our experiences to those so they could be on the ground building not only a viable democracy, but participating as the new holders of power in South Africa. We met with Mr. Mandela, and you know, I've heard a lot of speeches and I've heard a lot of politicians talk and what have you, but very seldom do you get really captured by one. And he did that to myself and I suspect others. On his release, he did the Democracy Now! Tour and came to the U.S. He met with our AFSCME leadership. As a matter of fact, he spoke at our convention. And he captured our folks because it was not a pie-in-the-sky piece, a speech, or it was not political. It was just about the rights of working people. And their role in the building a free and democratic South African society. So, I mean, if there's a high point in my limited lifestyle, it's that.
Thank you for sharing that story. You know, I appreciate your time, and I know we're kind of coming to the end of our talk today, but I wanted to mention, you know, I work mostly with students, you know, 18 to 22, 23 years old. And the thing I appreciate about what Rutgers students do is that they teach me about the way that the world is today for young people. Mm-hmm. And any kind of cynicism that one at my age might have gets wiped away because they have a hope for the future and in their own lives, and also broadly speaking for I think everyone else in society. And we're going through such a transitional and you know, scary moments in world history and certainly our national history. And you know, in some ways it reminds me of the moment in the 60s when the Black freedom struggle was, as it always has been, so connected to working rights as well, rights in the workplace. And I wonder if you, thinking about our young students here, both Rutgers and around the world, do you have any insight or any thoughts, any advice about how to think and act in this moment?
Well, in all honesty, this is their moment. The world is changing so fast and in so many different ways that they are the perfect group that's in position to help shape the direction. Right now, we're in the middle of a pandemic, you know, which will end at some point in time. So what's the workforce going to look like at that point in time? Will it be a massive slice of the working poor? Or will we have voices in the global places where decisions about a new workforce is going to be made? That's a job for young people and young leadership to take on. It's also a responsibility, I think, of our current trade union leadership is to prepare these folks for the coming world. I mean, you know, sooner or later, there will be a new hammer, you know, and who's going to help figure out what to do with it? My concern is that the politics of trade unionism is to hold on and not, you know, develop a deep bench that can help advance your industry or advance your particular union. I think we got to get out of that mindset and really prepare young leaders and particularly those who have a higher level of education, because the world is changing so fast. The blue collar, you know, approach is going to be necessary, but we need some other things. And to open up the spaces so these people can get the skills they need right now. And hopefully they will be on the trade union side of the ledger. I mean, offering their skills to help build unions. And I would offer one other suggestion, I'll quit. I mean, some of our unions who have, you know, unfortunately wound up in dying industries, really ought to be given some thought to how do we help form a stronger institution on the trade union side. And I've seen some who they will hold out to the bitter end, and then they'll merge with somebody. So what you've got now is two small, weak organizations charged with the responsibility of representing the needs of working people. And we ought to have a broader vision as to what to do before we get so weak we can't represent our membership.
Well, Mr. William Lucy, on behalf of everyone here at Rutgers, I really appreciate your time this morning and all that you taught us in our conversation. I really enjoyed this opportunity.
Well, thank you. Enjoy. You hear the rants and ravings of a tired old man. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk. I appreciate it, man.
You too. Thank you so much, sir.
All right,
bye-bye. Thanks for listening to A Third of Your Life, the Rutgers School of Management and Labor Relations podcast. For more information on our academic programs, faculty, and research, visit smlr.rutgers.edu.